the complete works of William Shakespeare, as told by... Tonight's episode, Cymbeline. Cymbeline is the king of Britain. His daughter Imogen, has secretly wed beneath her station to posthumous Leonidas. This does not sit well with the king, who had planned on marrying his daughter to his stepson Cloten, and ensuring an heir to the throne. In a rage, Cymbeline banishes Posthumus, and so in exile, Leonidas finds himself in Rome, and he's there with some drunken Roman guards who are prattling on about their women and how great they are. And so Posthumus interrupts and recounts the virtues and beauty of his beloved Imogen. And at this point, a Roman warrior by the name of Little Iago is what some critics have called him, as I read later on. Anyway, he bets Posthumus that he can seduce Imogen and steal her heart and her virtue. And Posthumus' confidence is, yeah, whatever, that's fine, let's bet on that. Meanwhile, Imogen's stepmother, who is also the current queen of England, plots to take out whoever she needs to ensure that her son Cloten is crowned king. She convinces a doctor to give her mortal drugs to try out, you know, for fun, on the little creatures, dogs and cats and such. The doctor, however, suspects there's more to it than this, and switches the mortal drugs for ones that'll just knock the person out for a time and give them an appearance of death. Very common, apparently, in Shakespearean times, this kind of stuff. The queen gives these medicines, claiming they're uber restorative, to Posthumus' servant, a guy by the name of Pisanio, I think? Akimo arrives in Britain and realizes he really can't seduce Imogen. She actually is just as great as Posthumus describes her. And instead, he asks her to guard this trunk for him that is filled with valuables, and he doesn't trust his shipmates. Can she just, you know, watch over it? He's leaving the next day. He needs someplace secure to lock it in a vault and everything. So Imogen says, oh, no, that's fine. She agrees. You know my husband, Posthumus, you're a good guy. That's fine. We'll keep it in my room. That's about as secure as it comes. So that night, as Imogen sleeps, Akimo arises out of the proverbial Trojan trunk and snatches a ring from Imogen and writes down or memorizes details of the room so he can describe it later and make it seem like he was there and stole her virtue. He returns to Rome, and he convinces Posthumus that, in fact, he did win Imogen's virtue. Posthumus, in a rage, dashes off an angry letter to his servant Pisanio, asking him to lure Imogen to a seaside town and then to slit her throat. Back in Britain, let me digress for just one second. It's what you do if you find out your wife slept with somebody, I guess, is this master plot from some guy that you only met in a drunken rage. Anyway, back in Britain, Cloten clumsily tries to woo Imogen, who informs the apish suitor that Posthumus' meanest garment, is more dear to her than Cloten. This sets Cloten in a rage and will pay off later. The ambassador from Rome, Caius Lucius, arrives in Britain, demanding the long-ago-agreed tribute from England. It's like 3,000 pounds or ducats or something or other that was way back from when Caesar was around, and they've always been paying it, except the queen, who has, you know, recently married the king, Cymbeline, and is trying to get her son Cloten the crown and everything. Anyway, she has spurred her husband to break off from, you know, paying the tribute and to fight the Roman army, and so a war is therefore set in motion. We cut to a mountainous cave in Wales, where we meet Bellarius, who long ago, before the play even started, was wrongfully accused and banished by Cymbeline. In retaliation, Bellarius stole the king's two sons and raised them as his own for the past 20 years or something. The differing names and dueling identities of all everybody's involved complicates matters, and it's really complicated. I can't even tell you who is who, really, at this moment in time. It's like Rosencrantz Guildenstern times 20. Of which one is which and what one does what. Anyway, truncating it, Pisanio has brought Imogen to the woods and reveals what his master would have him do to her. And Imogen is heartbroken and can't believe that her husband would say such things, that her can't believe that such things were said about her, and she wishes to die, because if that's what her husband thinks of her, she should just die. Pisanio says, that, you know, that's not why I brought you out here. I know I'm telling you that's what it is, but the fact of the matter is, you know, he's trying to help her, and so... He gives her some clothes, and he tells her that she should fake her own death and travel to her own dress as a man to suss out what's really happening. And so Imogen assumes the identity of Fideli and encounters the woodsman. She stumbles through the woods and finds the, you know, Belarius and the two his two sons, quote unquote, in the woods, who take him slash her Imogen in as a brother. You know, she's weak and exhausted from hunger and from traveling and stumbling about the woods, and she therefore takes the restorative drugs that Pisanio gave her from the queen, which of course leads her into a false death. The hunters have gone out hunting, leaving her to recuperate, not realizing that she now has apparently taken those drugs and has died, and they'll come back and find her dead. But anyway, they encounter Cloten dressed in Posthumus's meanest garments, because Cloten has this big plan to ravish Imogen, and he knows where she's going to be because he discovered the letters from Posthumus to her, telling her to go to the seaside town with Pisanio. Guiderius, I think is who it is, fights the scurvy knave, Cloten, and chops off his head, which one does, because he was insulted, and, you know, the guy deserved to have his head chopped off, apparently. Anyway, Guiderius drags him back to the cave, where they find Imogen dead, and so they prepare this big funeral thing to honor them, and they do this big speech, this song that I'll tell you about in a little bit. But anyway, they find her dead and can't believe it, so they bury them and go through the rites or whatever, and they leave, and Imogen wakes up to find the headless Cloten, who is dressed as Posthumus, and she's inconsolable. She can't believe that that's what's happened. At that exact moment, the Roman army comes through and discovers her, and she plays like a man, says she's Fideli, and that this was her master, and she becomes the servant to Ambassador Lucius, the guy from Rome. So anyway, the war is on, and when Posthumus hears that his servant has in fact killed Imogen, he is now inconsolable. He says something along the lines of, "Every good servant does not all commands, no bond but to do just ones." Which, you know, I mean, you're supposed to do the right ones, and you know, I was just following orders isn't acceptable, that's really blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he vows to fight on the side of Britain, even though he's been banished, because he's already killed Britain's mistress, Imogen, and he feels responsible, and he says how much more damage could he do for them, and he couldn't possibly betray her again. As such, he dresses as a peasant and joins the troops. And during the frays and the battles and everything, Posthumus, Belarius, and the king's two sons save the king and rally the troops and virtually quad-handedly defeat the Romans. In the aftermath, Posthumus wishes he were killed in battle and you know, is inconsolable because obviously Imogen's dead and everything. And so he vows to be taken by prisoner by whoever comes along next, and so that he could be executed for his crimes. Therefore, he claims he's Roman when a British officer comes along, and he's arrested and thrown in jail. In prison, Posthumus sleeps, and he has these visions of his ancestors populating the stage and invoking the name of Jupiter, and then Jupiter comes down from on high with thunderbolts and everything, and he makes an appearance, and he says, "Stop bothering me. Everything's going to be all right. Everything's being handled. I'm putting everything right. Just stop bugging me. It's going to be taken care of." So then, you know, at Cymbeline's tempt, all is made right, as each character sort of comes forward to deliver a piece of the riddle to solve all the problems. Belarius is thanked for saving the king presently, but then he reveals that his sons are, in fact, Cymbeline's. There's joy. The queen has died, confessing her sins, saying she never loved Cymbeline. She was just trying to get her son the crown. The doctor reveals that he switched the potions, though, and so Imogen, who has been captured with the Romans, is revealed to be alive and granted the right to marry Posthumus, since her brothers can take the crown. And through all of this, Cymbeline makes peace with Rome and agrees to pay the tribute anyway, even though they've defeated the Roman army trying to do the right thing. And so that's. Everybody's plotting. Everybody's got a plot. And it all sort of ties together at the end. The lines most critics seem to dwell on, comes in the funeral song, The Woodsman, for Fideli. The lines that begin, "Fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the furious winter's rages. Thou thy worldly task has done. Home art gone and taken thy wages. Golden lads and girls all must, as chimney sweepers come to dust." Me, I prefer the aforementioned line about every good servant does not all commands. I've collapsed the narrative as best I can, but I'm sure it's still way too convoluted. I'm pretty sure I've only just confused you, but by now you really should have come to expect that. The complete works of William Shakespeare, as told by me, Kevin Hannah.